Hello and welcome to Outthink Discuss number 2 with Carl Richards, where we're going to be talking about how to leverage your assets, how to move out of obscurity, and how to do luck on purpose. So I'm really glad all of you have joined me and joined us here. And Carl, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Tim. Thanks for having me.
So as we get started here, I want to introduce you to Carl Richards. And Carl is, he's the contributor to the New York Times and the Morningstar Advisor. He also wrote the book, Behavior Gap, Simple Ways to Stop Doing Dumb Things with Money. And he's also a certified financial planner and is the director of investor education at BAM Advisor Services. And so that's kind of the official bio. But, you know, I want to give just my impression of Carl and why I wanted him on and why I'm really excited that he's decided to join us for this webinar. Carl is, one of the smartest guys I know. He's always thinking of new ideas to grow what he's doing. His website is behaviorgap.com, which we'll look at here in a little while. And what's really neat about Carl is, he started out as a financial planner. He lives in Salt Lake City, Utah, or Park City, Utah, I guess he would want you to know.
Yeah, make sure you get that right. It's Park
That's
City.
Right. And just like the other, thousands of financial advisors around the country, he was helping his clients with their money. But what he was able to do that most people can't pull off is he's now, writing for the New York Times. He has his book out that's selling really well. They're already planning the paperback. And he's also getting invited to speak all over the world. And so what I want to do today is talk about kind of that transition. Whenever I talk to my clients, I always talk about how, the biggest fear that any author should have is not, somebody pirating their ebook or, any of these kind of obscure things. The biggest thing you're fighting is obscurity. And so he's done a really good job of fighting that. So that's why he's on. And that's why I think it'll be really helpful for you. And I'm excited that you've joined us. So, Carl, what I want you to do first is just kind of tell your story, how you got started in this world, kind of the initial transitions you went through and, relatively abbreviated version of how you went from, a financial planner, kind of running your own company to where you're at today.
Yeah, the abbreviated version almost always sounds a little crazy. So at the risk of sounding unbelievable, I'll just give you the abbreviated version. I was a financial planner trying to explain relatively complex subjects, at least subjects people feel like are very complex, to clients. I noticed, and I didn't have a background in sort of art or sketching or doodles, I didn't have any background. I didn't even know that I sort of did this. But I noticed after a couple of years that as I tried to explain these concepts, sort of investing or financial planning concepts, that things went better when I was writing on something as I was explaining it. So I'd either use the whiteboard, or if we were at lunch, I'd literally use like the back of a napkin or my Moleskin or a yellow pad, whatever was around. And I noticed that when I did that, and these were obviously like super amateur, I was simply trying, boxes and squares. I was simply trying to make this more understandable. I noticed as I did that, things went better. I had a client say to me one time, "Hey, that thing you just drew on the whiteboard, would you put it on a piece of paper so I could take it home and show my spouse?" And I remember thinking, oh, that's interesting, right? Like putting it on the paper was a little scary, and it was also very interesting. This paper goes out the door. A couple weeks later, another client said, hey, he called after the meeting and said, hey, that thing you put on the whiteboard, could you put it on a piece of paper, scan it, and email it to me? And as soon as I scanned it and saw it in digital form, I do remember thinking, oh, that's really cool. I could send it to more people now. It's digital. So somewhere along there, I started a blog. The first sketch I did was a sketch labeling something with behavior. We called it the Behavior Gap. I started a blog called the Behavior Gap. Nobody was reading it. Nobody. Like my mom, and I thought my sister was, but turns out she wasn't. So it was really just my mom. And I remember commenting to other people, like, it feels like crickets. Like, I put this stuff out there and nobody's reading it. Why am I doing this? But I was slow. I just had this sense of, like, and I remember saying multiple times to friends and family, like, this is like a bad addiction that I just can't stop. I'm just going to keep doing it. I had no idea why. One of those sketches was a simple Venn diagram, and it was, you know, super obvious thing about investing. And it was called buy high, sell low, dumb was the sketch. It was called dumb. Anyway, I did that sketch, and I got invited about that same time. I got invited to speak at an industry conference. So somebody was reading it. I got invited to speak at this industry conference. I went and I spoke, and I thought it'd be cool to have T-shirts made of one of these sketches because I had. So I made some T-shirts. I took them. I was too scared to give them out, so I brought them all home. Put them up on the website. They all sold. So it was, you know, 50 T-shirts sold. People started putting pictures of themselves up wearing the T-shirts. Three people, if you Google Behavior Gap T-shirts, three people made videos of them opening the T-shirts. And then the Wall Street Journal found the T-shirt. They ran a little thing in one of their, you know, sort of back page blogs. I think it was called The Wallet. But it was, nonetheless, it was the Wall Street Journal. And so that was, you know, and all these things were just like these accidents that were so cool. And I felt like, okay, I'll keep doing it. And then really almost with not very much between that last experience with the journal and this next one, you know, the editor at the New York Times, he emailed me. I'm not kidding. The email came on a Wednesday. He said, and keep in mind, I was living in Las Vegas at the time. I hadn't really written for anybody. I have no art background. And the editor of the New York Times emails and says, I'd like to try an experiment with you. We did an experiment for a week. And then he said, why don't you do one a week for us? I've been doing that for 2 years. And so that abbreviated version, you know, and then the book thing happened the same way. I got a call on a Friday afternoon from Portfolio, you know, the business imprint at Penguin. It was the lead editor at Penguin or a Portfolio saying, hey, we'd really love to talk to you about writing a book. I've printed out what you've written. I've organized it in chapters. You know, have you thought about that? And it turned out I had an agent. I couldn't get through the proposal process because it was driving me nuts. So I told the editor at Portfolio that. She said, well, what if we try and make you a preemptive offer so you don't have to finish the proposal? And I said, look, I'm a little kid from Park City, Utah. I don't even know what that means. And she called my agent. They worked it out. And 3 days later, we had a deal. And what that abbreviated version misses is a whole bunch of fear and concern and, you know, quiet, you know, doing something without anybody. You know, what it misses is all the time I spent playing in the traffic without getting hit. So that's the abbreviated version. That's led to now to an art business. Imagine that, right? Like so that's the abbreviated version.
Well, and that's kind of what you said about, you know, playing in traffic and hoping you get hit. I think, you know, that's the place I want to start here. You know, a lot of times I think two things happen that kind of perpetuate this false idea of luck. The first thing is that it's really hard to look at somebody like you and see the path between obscurity and where you're at now. You know, like it's really hard to understand that middle part because people don't like to talk about the time they were sitting in their closet crying because nobody was paying attention to what they're doing. You know, so people don't talk about it. And so it's hard to see that path. The other thing is a lot of people with this, I understand it's this sense of they don't want to become across as prideful. They want to be humble, but they call it luck. And I think that you can talk about luck. You know, somebody talks about how, you know, they were on the elevator. They got on an elevator at a conference and Jack Welch was there beside him and they started talking to him and it turned into this huge thing, you know, some crazy thing like that. But what they fail to talk about is most people sit at home and don't go to conferences. And most people, if they'd gotten on the elevator with, a big time business person like Jack Welch, would have never spoke up. And so there's this idea of doing enough stuff so that you can be lucky. You know, tell me about that. Like, you know, you talked about the T-shirts, you talked about putting the sketches online. Like, what are some other things that you tried that didn't work?
Yeah, this is a great talk. There's so many things that get in the way of doing stuff, like, and I always refer to it as playing in traffic. And we get so scared and nervous, and I, this is the one thing I want to hit, like, early on, is that that fear, and I know what it's about. I mean, the fear of, like, having people see your stuff and putting it out there, whether it's writing or art or whatever it is, putting it out there means you're exposing yourself to judgment, and that's scary. And I don't care how experienced you are, how old you are. I mean, that's just scary. It was scary when we were 10, and it's scary when we're 40. And I just want – one thing I want to make clear is it doesn't go away.
Yeah.
And the difference between people who you see, like, wow, that person's been really successful, and people who haven't, are they do it anyway, right? Like, the fear didn't go away. I mean, I'm scared every single Thursday. I'm supposed to turn in a sketch to the New York Times on Thursday. I always turn it in, like, late Friday afternoon. Why? Because I'm scared. And I'm scared that of the exposure, the comments, the feedback. It's scary. But guess what? I do it anyway. And I've learned to sort of enjoy that fear. So anyway, I think that's the first thing is, like, realize the fear doesn't go away, but do it anyway. I mean, like, literally just grit your teeth and do it anyway. And then this obscurity thing, it's like we've got to realize, like, if you – I'm not very good at a lot of things, but I'm pretty good at having an opinion. And we can all be pretty good at having – we can all be pretty good at having opinions. And what's interesting is if you're willing to express that opinion publicly, that makes you remarkable. Like, just that action alone, being willing to express an opinion publicly – putting your stuff out there publicly makes you remarkable. And when I say remarkable, it's sort of in the Seth Godin, you know, definition of worth remarking about.
Yeah, it doesn't mean it's good. It just means it's worth – it doesn't necessarily mean it's good. It just means it's worth remarking about.
Well, the cool thing is you don't actually – I don't think it's your right to decide if your work is good. It's an interesting concept. I think it's the world's right to decide that. And the cool thing about the world we live in right now is – If I had started doing this, you know, 20 or 25 years ago, I would have drawn one of these sketches. I would have shown my mom. She probably would have said it was a bad idea. I would have shown a neighbor, and they would have said, Carl, go back to learning accounting. Now, because the audience is so frictionless, I mean, it's like so easy to get your stuff out to this huge audience, you know, by just putting it up on a website. I mean, you don't even have to do that. Put it up on Facebook if you want. And now suddenly, no matter how bad, quote unquote, your stuff is, somebody's bound to like it because there's so many people out there. So I think, right, I don't think you decide. Some of the sketches I do for the Times that I think are absolutely the worst end up being home runs. And some of the ones where I think, I nailed this, this is so good, end up just crickets. So I don't think you'll get to decide. It's not your right. And I'm being a little facetious here. It's not your right to decide whether your work is good or not. Just get it out there. So, yeah, there was years and years of, like, I mean, literally, what, seven years of nothing.
Yeah.
And so it was just get it out there. And then the other thing I realized is once you were remarkable, and it's – I'm saying this with a huge dose of humility. Like, I still – I'm surprised by all this, but once you have an opinion and you get it out there and it's remarkable, people start remarking about it. You don't have to beg people. You don't have to ask. You don't have to walk around saying, please follow me, please retweet me. You just have to. There's no secret. You have to do good work. And again, it's not up to you to decide if it's good. Do the work that you feel passionate about and get it out there and repeat it for years.
Yeah.
And then stuff happens.
Yeah, and what I've noticed too is that you know, in working with clients is that you never know what's going to hit. Like the thing, like you were saying about, you know, this sketch you think would be awesome, that one you won't. It's not only that; it's even bigger than that. It's like you just never know what's going to hit. You never know what's going to make a big difference, and you never know kind of, you know, what it's going to transition into, because you don't even probably do you even know which. You know, which of your sketches got that New York Times person to email you in the first place?
No, that's such a good point. Like the other, it is bigger than that in the sense of like, you don't know where you're going next. Hmm. I mean, you know, like I had, like if you had told me 2 years ago or 3 years ago, yeah, 2 years ago before the New York Times, like I get emailed all the time at people saying, how did you get your stuff in the New York Times? And and I get asked all the time, like, who's your PR firm? Let's just get like super clear about it. I have no PR firm. I've never had, like, I had a, the Penguin hired a PR firm for the book, but before that, and I don't have a personal PR firm. I never have. And so the answer is always like, I don't know. If you told me that was going to happen, like the art show, how did you get an art show? I have artist friends who are upset at me. And I don't know. And the only reason that I think, the one thing that I think is a skill is like recognizing the way the wind is pushing you and saying, hey, why don't I, which I think is an interesting title for this conversation, is sort of leverage. Why don't I leverage these quote unquote happy accidents and keep going that direction? But the happy accidents don't happen unless you play in traffic.
Yeah, and so I actually want to come back to that. So when you're talking about playing in traffic, you gave some examples of what you've done. I'd like you to give some more examples of what you've done and focusing in on authors, because I want everybody listening here to be able to walk away and have something they can try next. And so you have this great thing where you sketch ideas on napkins. And so, a good excuse somebody could walk away with is, well, I don't do that, so I can't do what Carl does. But so I want you to talk about some other things you've done that are that playing in traffic idea and waiting for something to hit you, and things that you think any author should be doing or should be thinking about doing, or things they can try to start putting their stuff out into the world so that people can run into it.
Yeah, I think yeah, just break it down to like sort of micro publishing is my thought on it. Like think of, and I'm working on this now, like there's nothing that says you have to, and we all do this. I mean, I know what we all do. We sit around and we say, okay, I got to get this outline done. Okay, after I get this outline done, I got to do this chapter and this chapter, and that chapter's not perfect. I got to go back and I got to go research. And like we just play with our tools all the time. And instead of playing with your tools, like, what if you just had something to say about this? And I'm thinking nonfiction, particularly like, business books are the easy one. Like, you've got some little micro thing that you could publish. And by micro, I just mean a page, 10 pages, and then get them. And this is all, Seth Godin's had a huge impact on the way I think about these things. And it's just, all we're trying to do is have an opinion and then make it easy to share. And so if you can, there's a million ways to do that, right? I mean, if you're a fan of Twitter, you can use Twitter to do that. You can use Facebook to do that. I think it's really cool to create some souvenir, meaning sort of at least PDF, or ebook. I mean, what's the barrier to entry now to get a free ebook on Amazon?
Very
I mean,
low. Yeah.
yeah, I mean, it's like, so why not get a free book on Amazon? And do you realize once you have a book on Amazon, it's the craziest experience. People suddenly think you're way smarter than you are. At least in my case, people think you're way smarter than you are. So you get this free book, ebook on Amazon. Nobody cares or knows that it's like free or any of that stuff that we're all worried about. Like it's not published by a major house. Nobody knows. We're the only ones that know about that. We're the only ones that worry about that. All people think is, wow, it's available on Amazon, I'll go download it. So that to me, like, look, take one of the ideas of the concepts you've had. I mean, another interesting example is Dan Sullivan, the strategic coach. Go to Dan Sullivan's site, the strategic coach, and just spend $25 on one of his books. I don't care if you want it or not. Just spend $25 on one of his knowledge products. And when you get it, you'll be blown away. I mean, it'll be like 10 pages and a CD, an audio CD. And people are buying those for $25 all day long. Do you have one idea? Like the gratitude principle, I think, is one of his. It's just a simple book about how being grateful will help you in business. I mean, to me, that's one of those like, wait, Dan Sullivan's doing this. Why can't I do it? Let's take an idea. Like the overconfidence conversations, one I'm working on. I'm also working on one called the 72-hour rule. And it's a simple concept that before you buy anything, you should wait 72 hours. That's not rocket science. Could I write 10 pages about it? Absolutely. Would it be valuable to people? Well, they'll be the judge of that, but I believe it will be valuable, or else I wouldn't do it. So there's some, hopefully that's what you asked.
Yeah, and what you said there too about, will it be valuable to people? Kathy Sierra talks about, you shouldn't be trying to get fans, you shouldn't be trying to get people to be fans of you or fans of your writing. You should be getting them to become fans of themselves, of, when they're done reading what you write, who are they as a person? Are they better as a person? You know, have they been entertained or thought provoked? You know, they had a thought provoking idea because of your fiction writing, or are they going to be able to run their business better? And so, you know, this idea of being relentlessly helpful, you know, how does that play into some of the stuff you did? Because again, you started with just sketching stuff out for your clients, and so it was obviously helpful for them. So, you know, what role does, you know, does it play of, like, we're talking about marketing, getting your stuff out there, but at the same time, it comes back to this idea of being relentlessly helpful and helping people change their lives. Like, what does that play into when you're thinking about sketches or what you're going to write?
Yeah, that's super intimidating. And I think that's part of the, like, the big fear, the resistance, as it's called, is I'm, you know, like, we're so, I'm just, I guess what I try and get across is, you will be surprised at how helpful your stuff is. And you don't feel that. We all suffer from the imposter syndrome, this idea that we don't belong. And who are you to start, who are you to write a book, right? Like, that feeling is pretty universal. I've heard that most presidents about a week into office have the exact same experience. Like, oh my gosh, I hope nobody finds out I'm here. So I think we need to realize that, look, this is one thing I'm really trying to hone internally, and it's for sure true. If you feel like something's interesting to the point of, like, you have to get it out, like, to me, these sketches, it was like I just couldn't stop it. And so if you've got a problem that you're working on trying to solve, a lot of the stuff I do is really, like, the subtitle of the book, Stop Doing Dumb Things with Money, I'm uniquely qualified to write about that because I've done lots of dumb things with money. So I was trying to answer questions that I was dealing with personally. And when I found the answer, I thought, wow, that was really helpful to me. You just have to believe in your gut that if it was helpful to you, it will be helpful to lots of other people. Yeah. And so I don't believe in doing stuff that I don't believe in. And I'm not just trying to sell, you know, information products to anybody I can cajole into buying them. So I think we just have to get over the imposter syndrome, you know, stop being surprised. I mean, I'm still surprised, so I don't think we ever stop being surprised, but don't let the surprise that other people like and find your stuff useful prevent you from doing it. And yeah, so
I want to stop there for a sec, because I think that's an important point, is to understand that in today's world where we're all connected and you can reach out to everybody, you know, that is possible. There's going to be people out there that are just like you, struggling with the same things you're struggling with. I kind of use, there's this online store called thinkgeek.com, and they sell all these, like, really nerdy, like, Star Wars, Star Trek, like, nerd products that I love. But, you know, you could never open that store where I live in Lynchburg, Virginia. It would close within a week, you know, because we just don't have enough people here in town that are into that stuff to support a store. But you put it online, and now all of those people have a place to congregate online. And so being afraid, you know, if you're feeling something, if you're dealing with something, other people are feeling and dealing with that same thing. So when you're thinking about writing and putting your stuff out to the world, you know, how important is it to, like, be clear about who you're helping and clear in your mind about, like, this isn't for people that already know this stuff. This is for people like me that are still learning.
Yeah, I think part of that's being open, you know, and okay with being vulnerable in public, and which goes back to that earlier conversation about just not being scared. I think it's so interesting. I mean, we're all struggling with the same things. I mean, the chances are, if you're, like, I'm really working right now on a project about overconfidence, because I've been through in my life times where I got overconfident and it cost me a lot of money and a lot of heartache and a lot of stress and even some health issues. That overconfidence, the mistakes I made from being overconfident. So I'm now really trying to figure out, well, what is overconfident? Guess what? I think as I go on that journey, I can make that journey public and I can start writing about it. And then ultimately, you know, we'll see where the path goes. But my thought is, having seen it happened before, is that it leads down another similar path where I produce some book or course or something to help people find out what I found out about overcome. It doesn't make me an expert. It doesn't mean I won. It just means, look, I went down this journey. I'm going to share it with you. If you're interested in learning about overconfidence and how to prevent it, this might be helpful. Hmm. Right? So I think the same thing, like if you're an artist, an author, anything, like it's just, we're all dealing with the same stuff. And the chances are, if you find something interesting, so interesting that you, I think this is a great, like, I remember a friend of mine who was, his dad was a really famous scientist. Not a friend of mine, a guy I read a story about. His dad was a super famous scientist. He was going to, you know, he was in science school. His dad, the science building was named after his dad. He was in science school and he came home one day. He's like, Dad, I just really don't love this. And he said, let me ask you a question. Do you think about it when you're walking home? He's like, no, I don't. He's like, well, then get out. You know, like, that's the kind of thing I'm talking about. Like, if you are thinking about a problem, working on it, when you're, you know, out on your bike or, you know, whatever it is you do, chances are there's lots of people who are doing the same thing and there's an audience.
Yep. Well, you know, so I want to touch on, you know, you said it real fast when you were kind of introducing you, and I asked you to be abbreviated, so, you know, that was fine. But I want to talk about this kind of transition you've made into the art world and how, and, you know, just from, you know, our previous talks, we always laugh because, you know, you use a Sharpie, you know, it's not rocket surgery here, you know, but, you know, people get, you know, really excited about what you're doing. So, talk about the transition into the art world and specifically things like, you know, how did you, you know, I would guess that a lot of people, if they got a call like that, they would say, I'm not an artist. Thanks, but no thanks. So first of all, what's your mindset when it comes to opportunities as they come in? You know, what is your mindset when you're looking at new opportunities? And then again, you know, talk, and this probably goes back to that imposter kind of syndrome we all have, but you know, what is it that you do to kind of show up and be able to have a stance that you are an expert and you actually belong there?
Yeah. Well, let's start with the opportunity thing, like opportunities coming in. So the first thing, and I just think it's really important to understand, I'm a, like a do your own thing. I don't know, entrepreneur is the right word, but I just firmly believe everybody should be out there, you know, building their own business, creating, you know, I believe everybody should be an entrepreneur. That gets me in a lot of trouble because there's lots of people who shouldn't. And they're fine with their. So I used to spend all my time, particularly with my brother and my brother-in-law. I was just driving them crazy. Like, no, you should. I'll fund the business. I'll buy you a truck. Start a window washing business. And my wife finally said, stop it. Right? Nobody wants to hear that anymore. Like, they don't want to do that. So, but I think if you want to start down this path, you know, the maker's life, then there is no excuse for like not taking every opportunity. So early on, it was like I took every opportunity I could. Anybody who asked me to do anything, I did it, I think. And I didn't, I had a job. So there's no, I love Gary Vaynerchuk, this whole idea of like, you know, I got this done at 2 o'clock in the morning when my eyes were bleeding, right? Like there is no, if you feel that hungry about it, don't let job get in the way, meaning do your job. Take care and don't sacrifice your family if family is important to you. But there's all those hours spent watching TV, poking around on Facebook, or sleeping, and use those. So early on, my approach to opportunity was, you know, initially to just pretend like I wasn't shocked because I was, and then say yes and figure out how to do it later. Like that was the times. I mean, clearly I was up all night writing 450 words. For the first time, like I did not sleep. There's no way. But I said yes and just determined to figure it out later. So that's my now. Of course, at some point you have to start being selective about what you want to do. But it initially it's like you take any opportunity that comes along. Okay, art. It was the same thing. One day somebody said, "Hey, I'd really like that sketch on a bigger piece of paper. Would you do that for me? And would you sign it?" And I was like, "Dude, brother, come on." Like now you're getting nuts. Like I there's no way I'm signing it. And he said, I'll give you $5 for an unsigned one. And I'll give you $25 for a signed one. I was like, give me a pen, right? Like I'll sign it. And that, you know, once I saw it big, I thought, oh, interesting. And we had some other people ask. So So then I started doing letterpress. I love letterpress. We started doing these letterpress prints. People started buying them. I mean, it was just one step at a time. People started buying them. Then a community art center called me and said, hey, would you come give a talk to us about creativity? And I was like, again, you know, like, you know, in my head, I was thinking, you have got the wrong guy. You know, there must be a mistake here. I got invited to exhibit at Parsons in New York. And the email, I didn't know what Parsons was, but it's a pretty big deal, I guess. And the email said, we love your work in illustration, and we'd like to invite you to exhibit. And I was like, illustration? I what? You know, the words work, illustration, and exhibit were totally foreign to me. So I actually replied, Tim, and said, I think you have the wrong person. And they replied, said, no, we know who we were. We know. We've seen these things. We'd like you to exhibit. I said, yes. I went out there. They had me lead a workshop. You know, and in the workshop, in the audience of the workshop was the lead designer at the New York Times and people who'd done covers of The Economist. And I was obviously intimidated out of my wits, but I just did it anyway. I figured there's a story, right? So then from there, a local art center called and said, we'd like to have you come give a talk about creativity. It was their monthly art talk. I went. At the end of the art talk, the exhibit director said, this is a crazy idea, but what about doing a solo exhibit here of your work? And I was like, you're right. That is totally crazy. Like, what would I do? And so I called an artist friend of mine and I was like, hey, I got this exhibit. And he's a real artist. And I had him over to my office. Like, what do I do? Do I have to start using like canvas? And I was drawing things on my chalkboard when I was explaining to him, and he goes, Carl, look, just what if you just did this stuff on chalkboards? So we had letterpress prints. We had Sharpie on cardstock, and you know the little signs that are next to artwork that say, like, you know, oil on canvas? I was adamant about these cards that are next to my pieces at the art show saying Sharpie on cardstock. And then I did some big chalkboards based on my real artist friend's advice. And that's, again, when I walked into that show opening night, I was imposter syndrome times 10 for me. Just like, who... totally confused. But then you get this feedback that people like it and you keep rolling with it. So I guess to wrap up that piece, it's just like say yes to the opportunities, figure out how to do it later, and realize the imposter syndrome is a normal part of life. Yeah. And that when you feel it, you're not alone, and do it anyway.
Yeah. Every author I've talked to, whether they're a top New York Times bestseller, or, you know, all the way down to somebody writing their first book, you know, it all comes, they're all nervous when their new book's coming out, even if it's their 21st book, they're just as nervous as the first one that everybody's going to hate it. And, you know, that never goes away.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Yeah. And so now I want to, you know, talk about, you know, so now, you know, what is your role as a financial planner? Do you still do, you know, like one-on-one financial planning? You know, what have you transitioned into?
Yeah, I mean, all this led to this the sale of my financial planning business to a larger company, which was really cool in and of itself. Like somebody buying a business is really kind of a nice little, I don't know that it was totally life-changing, but it was certainly a big, big impact. That was cool, but the reason I did it was A, because I knew I was finding myself more and more interested in this writing, storytelling, art, I care deeply about the families I was helping with financial planning, so I needed to find a great home for them. Turns out I joined that firm as I think of myself as their chief storyteller, but my official title is director of investor education. And so now, you know, and they're in St. Louis, I'm in Park City. And so they sort of, the CEO there is really, a really great person and essentially said to me, look, we just want to wind you up and leave you out in Park City. Just keep writing, doing art. My job is to try and help people make smart decisions about money. It doesn't matter what tool I use or where I do it. That's my job.
Yeah. Well, I think that's an important point too, is looking at, you know, your job is bigger than creating a 240-page book every 2 years or whatever it is. You know, your job as a writer or an author is much bigger than that. And from a practical level, right, that you know, with the current state of publishing, you need to have your own platform. You need to have people that, you know, are willing to buy your
Hey,
book.
Emily, do people believe that? I mean, like, this platform thing.
What do you mean?
Do people believe that you have better have your own platform? Like, do we need to emphasize it, or do people, is that now like an assumed fact?
Well, I don't mind hammering it home a little more.
Well, I think we should just make, if I still talk to people who don't understand that that's essentially settled doctrine. Like, there's no more need to argue about it. Like, you had better build your own platform. And it's so interesting to me. Like, I mean, I think you start, if you are starting from scratch, call your mother and your grandmother and say to them, look, I'm going to start releasing 450 words or 800 words a week of this project I'm working on. Can I email them to you? And like, we have no excuse. Like, maybe there's, and I'm a grandmother and mother, I know somebody who that's their story. They're like, I just started sending this stuff to my grandma. And my grandma started sharing it with friends. But I'm sure each of us could come up with 5 to 10 friends. I bet a lot of us could come up with 50 people who would accept an email from us.
Right.
Well, we better, like, that's how simple it is. Start thinking once a week. That's why, that's really, like, I was so excited to do the New York Times thing, but one of the main reasons I was excited was it forced me to do 450 to 800 words a week. I was simply thinking of that as I'm going to create content. Someday I'll have 60,000 words and I can curate that and create a book. I mean, I was, and so I think if we start building a platform, doesn't need to be a big scary thing. Find 10 friends that are willing to allow you to email them and say at the bottom of the email, if you don't like this, please tell me and I will not send it to you anymore. They will spread it. Say something remarkable. Do it for a long time. You'll wake up one day and there will be 10,000 people who are willing to listen to you.
You know, and I, but what you're saying there, I really want to hammer home because all my interactions with authors, there are so many that won't even do that first thing you said, which is invite their mom or their friend to pay attention. And I, you know, I want to combine right here two things that we've talked about and make sure we kind of hammer them home. First is you're doing things that you think are helpful. You know, pretty much every writer I've ever talked to, you know, they're not getting into writing books to make money. There's usually easier ways to make money. They're getting into it because they love it and they want to add to people's lives in one way or another, whether it's, you know, adding good stories, good entertainment, you know, good self-help, whatever. They want to impact people's lives in a good way. But then when it comes time to actually invite people to join them, they just stop. I hate self-promotion. You know, that's too self-promoty, whatever, whatever. And I want to combine these two things is that if you're doing good work, if you're doing good art, good writing, and you're putting it out into the world, it's good for people. So you need to invite them into something that's good for them.
Yeah, it's. I have a good friend who is a woman professional mountain biker, and she's gone from like, you know, the easiest class, like the beginner class, it's called sport class in mountain bike racing, to professional on a national level in 2 years, and she's 30 and she's a mom and she, you know, all these, like, there's no excuse for like. You go down the list of like, well, she must not have kids. No, she has kids. She's all those things. And I keep telling her the same thing. I'm like, do you realize how powerful your journey is? And she feels the same way. Like, I understand that feeling of like, no, nobody'd find this valuable. I totally understand that feeling. But it's just, we got to do it anyway. It's just not true. Like, and that's what I keep telling her. Like, do you realize how many people, and then maybe even more specifically, how many mothers or how many women would like to see this journey as inspiring and either live through it vicariously and that will help them, or use your journey as a way to make some change in their life. And she's finally doing it, and it's incredible the people that are flocking around her now. And she didn't think this is a byproduct of what she was already doing, which I think is what you're saying. Like, you already have an interest, you already have something you want to share. Just please, the imposter syndrome is normal. This fear is normal, but do it anyway.
And that is what will set you apart. You know, we talked about being remarkable and there's a few little things that just set people apart. It's kind of that whole, you know, you probably had a friend that was like, well, I thought of eBay 5 years before that came out. And you're like, why didn't you build it? You sat on your ass, you know?
Right.
And it's like, that's the kind of stuff that I think, I really want, you that are listening to take away from this discussion, is that the only thing that set Carl apart from other financial advisors doing the same type of stuff, I'm sure he wasn't the first one to draw something on paper to get people to understand. He actually took those steps to put it out into the world and face that fear and did it long enough that it hit, and that's what I want the encouragement to be, is don't wait till it's perfect, right? Was your stuff perfect when it went out?
Yeah, it's still not even close. And before you do this little wrap-up thing, I need to, just one quick story that always helps me. David Bach, who's written The Millionaire, I can't remember, all like Retire Rich, Retire Young. I mean, all these New York Times bestsellers, he's like, he may be America's financial advisor now. I remember he was on Oprah, and Oprah said, David, what's the secret? And he leaned over, and in Oprah's ear, he whispered, obviously loud enough that everybody could hear, and he said, pay yourself first. And I need to, there was a collective groan of millions of financial advisors across the country. Like, that is not a secret. Like, we've been saying it forever. And then somebody reminded me, but David Bach's the only guy saying it on Oprah.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that's what's interesting. Like, you got to get out there and tell the story and not sit around waiting for some lucky break, because they don't happen until you play in traffic.
Yeah. Well, and I got a couple more things I want to talk about, but I want to say, if you're listening and you have any questions, if you've signed on to the GoToWebinar thing, there's a little box there for questions. Go ahead and start putting them in there. And towards the end, if you guys have any questions, Carl and I will take some of them and talk about them. So go ahead, type in your questions now, so we can come back to them. So what I want to talk about, one thing that we haven't touched on that I'm sure kind of goes into these other things, is your speaking career. And I know a lot of authors, especially in the nonfiction world, really want to grow that side of the business. What kind of led into that? Was it just same thing, people calling and you accepting, or have you done anything to ramp that up? And when you do get the speaking event, the speaking things, what do you tell them that you even speak on? Is it just personal finance, or do you have like specific things you speak on?
That's such an interesting question. I can't remember what happened first. I need to figure that out. I was trying to remember the first sort of paid. This is such a crazy world. I'm telling you, it's just such a crazy world. Art and speaking are the two craziest worlds I've ever been in, because you determine the price. And what's nutty is, I'm telling you right now, it is not any, I'm trying to be careful about the statement, I don't believe it's any harder to get paid $2,500, to get paid $15,000 to give a speaking engagement than it is to get paid $2,500. I don't believe it's any harder. And that may sound just totally ludicrous, but it's the same thing with art. We priced this art at the art show. I didn't know how to price it. Like, nobody knows how to price it. So I asked, I looked around, I was like, there must be, I'm business, sort of a business person. Like, what? There must be a way to price it. Nobody knew. So we picked some prices and people paid it. So speaking and art are this really crazy world, because I think they are, speaking as performance art. So speaking, I had the same experience where it just sort of happened. And now I get emails 2 to 3 times a month, probably, asking if I'll come speak. I don't have a speakers bureau. I don't have a PR firm yet. And I don't even really have a page on my site yet that talks about speaking. We just haven't had time to even get it done. So in my mind, like, the thing that helps the most is the same exact scenario. In fact, I'm sure this is what happened, now thinking through it. Video, me sitting down and taking a concept, and it could be a chapter out of the book, it could be a story out of the book. I started doing these videos years and years ago, and I didn't even know where most of them went. I had forgotten. And then you'll get an email saying, hey, I saw this video. Do you do speaking engagements? And that's sort of how the happy accident happened. Now I'm trying to leverage that happy accident and be more purposeful about it. And spell out when and where and exactly what topics. I originally just spoke about personal finance, but now I'm speaking more and more about this subject, about creativity. The talk I give now is called The Accidental Artist. It's sort of this year's talk. It's called The Accidental Artist, which is almost this story, but it's still very interesting and valuable to, you know, financial planning firms, because I'm talking about art and creativity, but the tools or the method or the examples are all about money. And again, I think any author could do the same thing. Like, you could talk about the writing process or creativity. You know who's done a great job of this? Is it Austin Kleon? Is that how you say his last name?
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah, you know, the steal like an artist thing. I mean, it's been amazing.
Yeah, well, and one thing Brent Weeks has done, he's a fantasy author, is he has a series on his blog about how to become a fantasy writer, like how to build worlds, how to build characters, how to get your agent. You know, so he's been doing that kind of stuff as well.
Yeah, so I think it's the same thing. Like, do stuff. Don't do stuff. You're going to be scared. Do it anyway. You're going to feel like an imposter. Do it anyway, and good things will happen.
So I want to come, you know, we've got a couple questions here. So I'm going to take one. One is from Shannon. Did you ever drag your feet on your project because you were kind of afraid of making it big? So, you know, this is a different kind of fear, not just what people would think, but, oh man, now I'm actually going to have people paying attention. You know, did you ever drag your feet because of that?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting, you know, I can't remember who did that, the original quote, but I heard it on Aquila and the Bee. You know, your greatest fear is that you'll become powerful beyond belief. I thought about that quote a long time, and I don't know that I ever dared believe that I would become big, and that's maybe just a reflection of myself. I don't even know that I haven't become big, but I think it's a different form of that fear for me, and the different form of that fear is, yeah, maybe lots of people will see this stuff. Not necessarily using the word big, but just lots of people will see it. And yeah, I drag my feet on projects like that all the time. Like, I'm getting invited to speak at places. I speak at Stanford Business School next week, and that scares the crap out of me, to use a really nice piece of language. So I'm delaying trying to figure out what I'm going to talk about. I already know what I'm going to talk about, but the answer is yes. I think you do, and I think you have to recognize that. And you have to realize, like, I love Stephen Pressfield's work on the resistance. Like, when you start feeling that inside, you know game's on, right? Like, okay, I'm scared to death. I'm feeling resistance. I'm checking Facebook for the 73rd time this morning. Time to get serious. This must be important.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting you said that. You know, I think, you know, one thing you've got to do is train yourself. You know, we all have triggers. You know, one of my clients is Charles Duhigg. He's got that book, Power of Habit. And he talks about how habits work, and every habit has a trigger. And what I think you've got to do is learn how to take that trigger, that trigger of fear that normally drives you to your email inbox or Facebook or, you know, FoxNews.com or whatever is your drug of
choice.
Please
tell me it's not Fox News.
You know, whatever your drug of choice is, you know, it drives you there, and learn how to use that trigger to actually drive you to be creative and drive you and realize that you don't have to run from this. You should lean into it.
Right. No, I think that's all good stuff.
So I got a question here from Gareth. Could you share a few more thoughts on making the most of luck opportunities? So the opportunities that, you know, I like to talk about, you know what emergence is, Carl, the science of emergence. You know, it's like, you know, ants, any single ant is stupid, but lots of ants together create amazing things. And, you know, some scientists would argue they're more advanced than we are as a group. And, but what happens is like every time they find food, it's an accident. Like, there's just an ant wandering around. They've actually studied this, an ant just wandering around, and then, oh, here's food. And then they lay down pheromones and all the ants find the food, but it's an accident that happens every time. And these opportunities, as you put stuff out there, put your art out into the world, the opportunities always come up and they're always an accident. So what I want to drive home here before you answer the question is this can happen for everybody. I've seen it. Every author I work with that constantly puts stuff out there, these accidents happen. They run into somebody, they get an opportunity. So talk about, Carl, how you can make the most out of these luck opportunities that are going to come across your desk as long as you're putting yourself out there.
Yeah, well, I guess first just to comment on that, that's totally true. Like nobody had a pl can you imagine making a plan as a guy with a Sharpie to have an art show? Like who would be nutty enough to do that? Like the idea of business planning to me is a myth. The idea of financial planning, frankly, is a myth. All these assumptions, we just don't know what's going to happen. So yeah, I think it's totally true that you don't know. So the question then is, when it happens, how do you make the most of it? And I'm not particularly quick or smart on these things because it takes multiple times. And I think as I told that story, like the first client said, could you put it on a piece of paper? Well, yeah, I mean, there was three examples, right? Clients, every time I got up to the whiteboard, it changed the nature of the conversation. People understood more. That wasn't enough. So the next client had to say, put it on a piece of paper for me. That wasn't enough. So the next client had to say, make it digital for me. Right? And then finally, it had to take years before somebody said, sign a piece of paper with it on there. And then I said, oh, maybe I could turn it into art. So to me, it's almost like if you're open to it, and maybe you can shorten that cycle, but I think if you can learn to recognize which way you're being pushed, the path, the next step on the path becomes pretty obvious. Like, oh wow, if I sign it, somebody will pay money for this, and it will have an impact on more people's lives. Maybe I should do a run of 100 and put it out there and see if 100 people buy it. And if they do, cool. Like, it's just always the next minimum step. And I think Eric Ries's work on the lean startup is really helpful for authors too. Like, he calls it the MVP, right? The minimum viable product. What's the least thing I could do in terms of commitment of resources, time, and money to see if this path continues? And if it dead ends, then I hate this term, but I'm going to use it because everybody understands. I need to pivot, right? I'll make a little change. But if the path opens up, I'll take the next step. So I wish there was a more scientific way to do it, but I think it's just, if you could learn to recognize which way you're being pushed, take the next step, see if you keep going that direction. If not, make a little tweak.
Well, and I think the thing to remember too, Jason Fried from 37 Signals talks about how almost there are so few decisions in life that you can't go back on, like short of like, kids and I don't know, not few, not many getting a tattoo, and even that's going away. But like, there's so few decisions that if you just walk down the road and you realize, oh, this isn't what I should be doing, you can just go back. So like you were talking about, it's not like, when you first got the inkling that somebody might buy a piece of your art, you didn't go out, build a manufacturing plant, get, 100 different prints and run 1,000 of them off. You just did 100 and saw what happened and then moved from there.
Totally. I think this idea of like having an idea, testing it, and then tweaking and iterating fast is, I mean, there's a lot out there now about that stuff. Tim Ferriss is a master at that. There's plenty of ways to test concepts. Even I didn't even have to produce that image. I could have made a digital image of that for, I could have done it myself, or I could have paid somebody $250 to make a digital image of exactly what that art would have looked like. I could have used a couple keywords, tested it for $5. Maybe I'm exaggerating, but I could have been out the door with a complete test for a couple $100, right? So anyway, hopefully that helps.
All right, next question here. So, how does innate fear relate to or come from the educational system? The fear of being the kid who was made an example of or embarrassed by authority figure within, that kind of stuff. Like being, this innate fear, some, I'm sure people have like really bad baggage from the childhood of, being embarrassed or made fun of or, whatever. Do you have any tips for people that will help them kind of get over some of that stuff? Because some of us, become really comfortable, we can beat that fear easily, and some of us, we get all tied up. So, if what are tips that you have to help people kind of move past some of that?
Well, I just think at least it helps me because look, I'm the same way, and to me it helps me a lot to understand that other. Go watch Elizabeth Gilbert's TED Talk on creativity, and you will understand that you are not alone, and you're dealing like Elizabeth Gilbert. I mean, Eat, Love, Pray, like that's it, she feels the same way, and Stephen Pressfield, Do the Work and the Art, the War of Art. It feels the same way. And there's examples. So to me, it helps me to understand, that we're not alone. that this is actually, it might even be called normal, right? It's not, yeah. It's not like a disease we have. It's actually normal. And the reason people find people like Elizabeth Gilbert so remarkable is because she does it anyway.
Yeah.
And like that act by itself is remarkable. And so I think I listen to that Elizabeth Gilbert TED Talk before, you know, not every single time, but often whenever I get nervous about a talk I'm going to give, I go listen to that talk. And I just realize, you know what? It's not me. If I'm terrible that day, she compares it to Dobby the house elf. Like if you're terrible that day, this will be helpful, right? Her premise is, and this is based on a bunch of sort of traditional lore, which is that at one time we viewed genius as outside of ourselves. Like we were just sort of almost like the tool,
the conduit
that was being used by genius. And whatever you want to call genius, you know, whether that's God or the universe or whatever that is, there's some genius out there and you're just the conduit or the tool. And she compared it to almost like Dobby the house elf, right? Like this, if you're good that day, you know, like you're good writing that day, you're good speaking that day, your house elf was on. And if you're bad, guess what? It's not really your fault. You just have a crappy house elf that day. And she gives a bunch of examples of people that, and then somewhere along the line, we switched and we started saying, you are a genius. And we started embodying it ourselves, and that was the danger point, where we started saying, because now, suddenly, if you're the genius, what happens the day that it doesn't go so well? You know?
Right.
And so it's helpful to me to view it as, like, that earlier way, like, it's a disembodied, it's not me. If it's good, you know, I'm going to try not to take a lot of credit for it, frankly. If it's bad, I'm not going to take the blame either.
Yeah. Well, and one thing that's helped me, I think, is to not focus on the end, just focus on the next step. So like I'm, you know that I'm working on my book right now, and how I was able to finish that book is I could not let myself think about what people are going to think about it when I publish it and it's actually for sale, because that's too scary. So all I did was focus on, I have to do 2,000 words a day until this thing is done. And that's all I care about. If the manuscript, the first draft in the manuscript is done, I'm going to consider a success. And anytime my mind wandered to something else, I wouldn't let myself think about it. Just the next step. And then after that, I can think about the next step. And it allows you to not worry about what's going to happen down the road or what people are going to think. All you're doing, all I had to do today was grind out my 2,000 words and I'm done.
Yeah, I think that's just great. I mean, it's the same. I ride a long mountain bike race that's a long, long, long ways. And if I think every September, well, I try to do it every September. And before that, we did this long road bike race. It's 206 miles from Logan, Utah to Jackson Hole, Wyoming. And it takes, you know, around 10 hours. And if you think about that, you know, chances are I'm not going to go if I think about, oh my gosh, but during the race, all it's about, it's not even about the next mile. It's about the next pedal, just this current. Can I push down on the pedals right now? And so I think if we get really present and just worry about now, like right now, then, you know, it's the same as breaking, you know, how do you eat an elephant one bite at a time? Like it's just breaking anything down to more manageable steps. They're less intimidating and you can get them done.
Yeah. And before we go, I can't not mention a book that came out last year by Jonathan Fields called Uncertainty. And if you really want to delve more into this and what, you know, what we've ended up spending a lot of great time talking about today, that's a great book to point out, is that book Uncertainty by Jonathan Fields. Again, when I send out the link to this webinar, I'll make sure to put a link to that book and the TED Talk that Carl just mentioned, everything else. But right now we're bumping up against the end of our hour, and I'm really trying to keep it an hour for the sake of your time and everybody listening. But, you know, Carl, you know, I really appreciate you coming on, and I know everybody listening got a whole lot out of it. It was really great. And, if you have any questions, you know, email me, it's tim@outthinkgroup.com, or, you know, if you got the email for the webinar, just hit reply to that and reply back to me. Carl can be found again at, behaviorgap.com. And so make sure you go there, check out his art, check out all the sketches. You'll really like it. And yeah, Carl, thanks for coming on.
Thank you, Tim. It was a pleasure.
All right.